From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the races for governor and lieutenant governor are heating up a year before the election.
Later, growing up in Greendale in the 1950s, Denise Chanterelle Dubois had never heard the term transgender.
There were different words for it back then, and they were all derogatory, which only increased my shame and guilt. It wasn't transgender. That came along much later. It was transsexual, transvestite, words like that, drag queen.
Then a play on stage in Milwaukee tomorrow tries to engage more of the community in tackling the mental health crisis.
Plus, 20 years after the release of her award-winning album, A Few Small Repairs, Sean Colvin says the best part of recording it was the low expectations.
We kind of made a pact, you know, like, we don't care. We think our songs are radio-worthy, but maybe in an alternate universe, you know?
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
Thanks for joining us. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's been a busy time for political posturing in Wisconsin. The race for governor continues to pick up steam as more Democrats keep entering the contest. And now candidates for lieutenant governor are also coming forward.
Last week, former Milwaukee legislator Mandela Barnes says he's running as a Democrat. Then Governor Walker all but made it official that he'll seek a third term by launching an ad that strongly indicates he's in the race.
WUWM's Marty Michelson asked J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com about the election news and other developments in Madison. Ross joins Marty each week from the WisPolitics newsroom to share his thoughts.
Every race seems to start earlier every cycle. So, you know, Mandela Barnes, talking to him, made the argument that he was somebody who could bring out voters next fall that Democrats, you know, didn't really inspire last year. That would be young voters, minorities, people from Milwaukee. Mandela is 30. He's African-American and represented Milwaukee in the state assembly. He seems to fit the bill in his argument of the people the Dems really inspired last time. And if you look at the field for governor on the Democratic side, most of the folks who are running are in their upper 50s and Caucasian. So you could make an argument that Mandela would have a nice balance to a ticket if one of those candidates on the Democratic side won the nomination for governor. Now, the flip side is, to be honest, that candidates for lieutenant governor don't often make huge impacts on the ticket. It's kind of like the vice presidential nominee every year. You just have to be able to not make a big mistake and hurt the ticket. You know, so Mandela can make that argument about maybe inspiring voters, but I don't know that most folks I talk to think that whether it's Mandela and Rebecca Clayfish on the stage in a debate for lieutenant governor, if they really turn that race next year.
Do you expect more candidates to announce for lieutenant governor in the coming weeks or months?
Some other names have floated. But as far as a high-profile candidate, there really aren't a lot of people who are dying to get that job right now. Rebecca Clayfish is fairly secure on the Republican side. So the question is kind of, will anybody else on the Dem side think it's worth a shot or be interested in running? You know, for Mandela, he's not in office right now. He doesn't have to give up a seat. If you're a lawmaker and your term is up, you're up for re-election next fall, you have to give up your seat to run. So it's a risky proposition. For Mandela, there's not that downside of giving your office. Now, of course, there's a downside for him possibly if they were to lose. He lost a bid for state senate last year. You start losing a lot of races, and it can really kind of hamper your political career. So it's something for him to watch.
At the same time, Governor Walker pretty much confirmed that he will seek another term in 2018 when he launched a video last week that asks, "Are you with me?" He's going to make an official announcement in early November. So what can we expect after he makes it official?
Well, things just kind of transition a little bit. After you announce, it's all about the re-election. You know, there's going to be a little more political analysis to what he says or the priorities lays out. I mean, let's be honest, everything the governor does, there's a political aspect to it, and we as reporters are following it, focus on that political piece. But this is a little bit different, you know, once he announces. And we'll see him ramp up a campaign staff. We'll see him, you know, more high profile with his fundraisers. I mean, Governor Walker's been raising money the entire time he's been thinking about running for re-election. So that's not going to change. It just becomes more high profile. There's a more emphasis on it. I mean, a little more the public consciousness, which is why I get the impression, you know, even though he wanted to announce this summer when the budget was done, they got delayed until September. But if you pay attention, he's been dribbling out little nuggets of news, like the new logo for his campaign. He released that digital ad last week and then did the official date he'll announce. It's all about, like, generating free media publicity and reminding people, hey, I'm going to run next year. I know we've been kind of wrapped up in that budget for many, many months in the Capitol, but here's something you should be paying attention to.
So what are some of the other items that you'll be keeping a close eye on in Madison this week?
The legislature is supposed to be on the floor for a couple days this fall. We have yet to get an agenda from the leadership of both houses. They're kind of like in this post-budget hangover phase where the state budget took up so much time, was so contentious, didn't get done until the middle of September. They're still kind of figuring out what do they want to do, what do they have support to do. There are big bills, like one to open the door to mining for precious metals, one about there's a bill to allow people to carry a concealed weapon in Wisconsin without getting a permit. There are ones about end the sale of fetal tissue. There's big ticket controversial bills that are pending. Just don't know yet if the legislature has the appetite to take them up and knock them out this fall or what will be in a brief floor period early next year.
WisPolitics.com editor J.R. Ross spoke with WUWM's Marty Michelson for their weekly Capital Notes segment.
A Milwaukee area native describes her identity crisis and the profound transition it led to when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. In 1953, Dennis Dubas was born in St. Luke's Hospital in Milwaukee. After decades of struggling with his identity, Dubas was reborn as Denise Chanterelle Dubois, the author of a new memoir, Self-Made Woman.
The book explores her life growing up in suburban Greendale, Wisconsin, struggling with her identity, an unstable home life, and ultimately drug and alcohol abuse.
Dubois was in Milwaukee earlier this year, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about growing up in Milwaukee and the many things that led to her transition later in life.
As I like to joke, the summer of love in 67 really didn't hit Milwaukee till 1972. So we were kind of sheltered, especially out in Greendale, from all the happenings that were going on with the civil rights movement here in Milwaukee and Father Grappi, things like that. The anti-war protests against the Vietnam War really didn't affect me that much. What did affect me, being a transgender woman here in my life, was being a transgender child in the 60s and needing to keep myself in the closet. That deeply affected me.
When you were growing up, did the word transgender ever come into your vocabulary?
Oh, there were different words for it back then, and they were all derogatory, which only increased my shame and guilt. It wasn't transgender. That came along much later. It was transsexual, transvestite, things, words like that. Drag queen comes to mind. Just really hurtful phrases, and not only along with those words, but the definitions that were attached to that. And it was humiliating. It was mean, and it made me afraid. And that's why I stayed in the closet all those years. It wasn't fun. Fortunately, things are really changing fast right now.
Yeah. You grew up in a Polish Catholic family around Milwaukee, an experience that I think a lot of our listeners probably also shared. But as you said, you were a transgender child dealing with a lot of complex feelings. How did your family handle this? And this is, of course, something that you get into in a lot of detail in the book. But what was that experience like?
Well, yes, you're right. I come from a completely Polish family background. My birth name was Dennis Edward Dubas. My new name is Denise Chanterelle Dubois. I kind of like that one a lot better. But it was interesting in that sheltered lifestyle that I had. My parents, blue-collar Democrats. My father was a tool and die maker at the AC spark plug plant in Oak Creek. My mother, she took care of us children growing up and later spent many years working for the GE plant out in Waukesha. So my parents voted Democrat, were liberal when it came to unions, of course. But when it came to sexuality in our family, it was never discussed. It was never brought out. There was nothing. And I felt very ashamed and guilty of myself. I knew very early on at age 4 that I wanted to be a girl then, of course, and those feelings never went away. It was an interesting experience for me. I was at my grandparents' lake cottage out in Waterford. I was 4 years old. It was 1958. And I fell off the dock and almost drowned. And my parents, I was rescued. And while my clothes dried, there was no dryer back then. It was a clothesline. I had to wear one of my cousin's dresses. And while I was wearing that dress, it was like an epiphany for me. And I realized at that very moment, these feelings I'd been having that were just starting to stir inside me crystallized in that one moment. And I knew I was transgender. And I knew at that very tender age that I was in for a rough row. When I tried to change back, or when my parents wanted to put my other clothes back on me, my father, and I didn't want to do it, my father just went ballistic. So right away, those feelings of guilt and shame were impressed upon me very early.
Well, and in a lot of ways, your experience growing up speaks to an issue that I think we're dealing with now in a slightly different way. So there's a lot of conversation right now about how we implicitly treat male and female children differently. You know, we hand female children dolls. We hand male children cars or robots or what have you. And the kind of impact that can have on them. But for you, a lot of what it was not so implicit, but really explicit. Stay in your lane, stay in your gender lane, whatever that might mean. In what kind of ways were you discouraged from really expressing your feelings?
Joy, I love the gender lane analogy. That's fab. Well, early on, my parents tried to get me involved in sports. I resisted. I wanted to play the Barbie game with my older sister and her girlfriends. We played house. I always wanted to be one of the girls in house, things like that. My parents were onto that, and they tried to steer me away from it, and I always tried to pull them back the other way. So I resisted trying to play sports, for example. I remember the Little League. I always played right field because I was the worst person on the team. I had a catcher's mitt in right field to catch balls with. That's not how you play outfield. Later on in life, as I absorbed my shame and guilt and internalized that and went deeper into the closet, I tried really hard to be Dennis. And at Greendale High School, I went off for the football team as a freshman, and I lasted 3 days. I quit. So that started my 4-year career at Greendale High School of being shamed as a quitter, and it deeply internalized that. And then I tried joining the wrestling team. A little bit later in high school, I got away from all that, and I knew things weren't going in the right direction for me by the time I was a senior, even earlier than that. Lots of problems were already starting to crop up for me in life.
What kind of problems?
Drugs, alcohol, resistance, acting out. In my book, I talk about all these things, and I began to numb myself and run away from who I really was. I wanted to forget who I was. And you know, Joy, you can never run away from your true self, and don't ever try to run away from your true self. If there's one thing I've learned, and I have learned more than one thing in my new life as Denise, embrace yourself. Embrace who you are. It'll make you a happier person.
One of the things I found interesting in your book, you just talked about drug abuse and that being an issue for a number of years. But in some ways, drugs were what led you to really becoming Denise, becoming who you are now.
Yes, and I can elaborate on that for you. It is very interesting when you think about this, because when I wasn't indulging in my drug of choice was speed. Here in Milwaukee, I can remember a situation when I was 19 years old. I was living on the east side off Brady Street. And back then, they were called Black Beauties. They were pharmaceutical amphetamines. They were available. I got some. I remember one time I took 2 Black Beauties at once, and I was sitting right here on the shore of Lake Michigan at Bradford Beach. The water was freezing. I went in, didn't even feel it because I was so high. But what happened when I'd be high on things like that, and later, in my later years, it became crank and then crystal meth in Portland, it would liberate me from the closet. I didn't care what others thought, and I would just come out and be Denise. So in a way, in an odd sort of twisted way, it led me along that path. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not condoning any of that substance abuse, because that's exactly what it was. It's the worst thing in the world you can do to yourself. But yeah, that's what happened to me when it came to that particular kind of drug. I wrestled with that addiction for decades, in and out of it, in and out of it. And then when I wasn't on that, I would drink a lot. I drank enough booze to sink a battleship. I smoked enough weed to burn down a Wisconsin cornfield, all in the attempt to numb myself. I was married for 15 years. When I got married, I told my ex-wife, I said, you know, hon, this is all behind me now. I told her about my secret life, as I like to call it. I was 34 years old when I got married. And I said, but it's all behind me now. I love you. And I did. And I still do. But as I mentioned earlier in this interview, you can never run away from who you really are inside.
That's one of the parts of your story that I think gets to a common misconception about trans people in general. A lot of people seem to conflate being transgender with homosexuality. They think that they're kind of one and the same, but it seems as though you have always been interested in women. When you were living as Dennis, when you live now as Denise, was that something that was confusing for you, given that kind of misconception?
It was never confusing for me. My sexual orientation early on, I knew what that was, and that never has changed. But yeah, that is an interesting aspect of all that. And I'm glad that you said that there's kind of a confusion out there about all this, because there's two reasons why I wrote the book. And the first was to help those out there who are still in that deep, dark pit that I found myself in for decades, because I know I can reach some of those people. And if I can just save one from suicide or for going through what I went through, if I can just save one, this is all worth it. And the second reason I wrote the book was to raise awareness of what it means to be transgender in society, because a lot of people out there don't understand what it's really all about.
You finally came out a lot later in life. What pushed you to have the gender confirmation surgery that you did end up having?
Yes. That happened 1 month shy of my 49th birthday. I was living in Manhattan at the time, flew to Bangkok, Thailand for my, it's called gender-affirming surgery, not used to be called sexual reassignment surgery. What happened was I cleaned up my act finally, and I came out. My wife at the time was in Christchurch, New Zealand. She had accepted a job teaching English at the University of Canterbury. I stayed behind in Portland, Oregon, to sell the house, to sell the cars, to help get our dog over there, things like that. I came out. I couldn't go back this time. And for the first time, I don't know what happened, but I didn't need drugs to do that. I felt like this is my moment now. And if I don't do this now, it's never going to happen. And I came out. And I, like as I mentioned in this interview, I still love my wife, my ex-wife, dearly, and I withheld the info from her for a while because I was internalizing that, and I finally broached it with her in New Zealand, and that was a real battle. In the end, I flew to New Zealand with the divorce papers. It wasn't a complicated divorce. We didn't really have much of anything. I spent a good month with her out there. It was a very rewarding trip. I'm glad I went, because we parted in peace. And that's all I ever wanted. I wanted her to move on in her life because she needed to.
What do you hope people get out of reading your book? Not just people who might be going through the same thing that you were going through, but people who are on the outside looking in as well.
I want to be able to help those who are on the outside to raise their level of consciousness and awareness about what it's like to grow up transgender from someone who is my age, who's approaching their mid-60s, and the trials and tribulations that I had to go through. And I think that that's helpful for those who are thirsting for this kind of knowledge. And I think there's a lot of people out there this has really blown up on the national stage for the past couple of years now. So in respect, being able to do that to the cisgender community at large out there.
Well, Denise, thank you so much for coming in today, and we're glad to have you back in Milwaukee.
Thank you.
Denise Chanterelle Dubois is the author of Self-Made Woman, a memoir. She spoke with Joy Powers, and for more information on the book, you can head to WUWM.com.
A coalition of groups comes together to present a play about the challenges of mental illness. We'll learn about it in a moment on Lake Effect right here on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, about one in five adults in the United States has a mental illness. In order to continue to bring attention to mental health and fight against the stigma surrounding mental illness, a collaboration of community organizations, health systems, and faith-based groups in Milwaukee are presenting a play called Pieces, In My Own Voice.
Written and directed by Brenda Wesley, Pieces portrays the struggles of living with a mental illness and emphasizes the darkness of stigma through spoken word, monologues, music, and dance. The play is the culmination of Mental Health Awareness Day, MKE, tomorrow evening.
Wesley and Pastor Walter Lanier of the Progressive Baptist Church of Milwaukee and Director of the Men of Color Initiative at MATC joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the play and the issues highlighted by Mental Health Awareness Day. Wesley began by explaining the origins of her play.
The play is based on my personal journey with my son living with a mental illness. He is 39 now, but he was diagnosed with paranoia schizophrenia when he was 21. As I went through this journey with him, I was actually trying to look at a form that I could use to talk about mental illness because of the stigma behind it, and using a platform that I could use that I could reach multiple people to deliver a message of education but also hope. And I actually started a African-American outreach called ASK, Access, Support, and Knowledge, where I went out into my community to talk about mental illness. Started with maybe five people in a group, and then it grew to 15, 20, 25, 30, 100. And then again, using my actual background of how to reach people, again, to deliver a message of hope and education around mental illness. And it came to me to write a play called Pieces in My Own Voice, where it pretty much illustrates what it's like to live with various diagnoses, the stigma around it. And we use music and dance and dialogue to deliver this message. Because I truly believe that arts is a way to really open up someone's heart, whether or not you can make someone cry, laugh, think, social issues, and just using the arts to deliver that message.
Does this play... It obviously includes things that you've experienced firsthand. Does it also include people who you've met through your various groups who have also struggled? Is it a combination of experiences from other people, whether they suffer themselves or who know someone?
Most of the cast live with a mental health disorder. They may have family members that live with a mental health disorder, or they have had family members that completed suicide. So each monologue really comes from a personal space of each. I call them actors, and I don't want to call it a performance. It's more of an outreach, but that's how we really engage the audience because it comes from a personal place within each of our actors.
You have two versions of the show, one for adults and one for children in schools. What messages do you think adults need to hear more than kids do because of the difference of life perspectives?
It's education and understanding that we're talking about a brain disorder as well. It's that education, and that's across the board. And when we have gone into the schools and we talk to youth, and they tell us is that we are so happy that you're here talking to us, but we need for you to talk to our parents as well. Because one example, a youth said that I went to my mom and told her that I was depressed. And her mom said, well, what do you have to be depressed about? Get over it. And so when we talk to the adults is that not only is mental illness real, But if you have a child that is coming to you with various issues or concerns, be it depression, anxiety, do not just put them off, but come to the realization that if your child had a headache and they had a headache for 2 weeks or maybe a day or 2 days, you would take them to the doctor, correct? So if your child came to you and said, I am experiencing this, not to just kind of shoot them away, but to listen to what they have to say. And this is one of the major messages that we get from youth is just listen to us. You know, just don't dismiss us, but listen to what we have to tell you.
Now, Pastor Lanier, you're part of the collaborative aspect of this play and with Mental Health Day in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And the play is a collaboration of community organization, health system, faith-based organization. You know, it spans across public and private. So where do you fit in personally?
Well, in 2011, I became the pastor of the Progressive Baptist Church. And in 2012, we launched a ministry there to raise awareness and decrease stigma inside the church and outside the church walls. Unfortunately, a place where people often come to get the most help and to be heard is a place where people are sometimes re-stigmatized and traumatized, and that's inside the church, usually out of a lack of knowledge. And so I saw that happening in churches in different places in the city, and so it really vexed my soul because my life experience was that the church is an affirming place, a liberating place, and a place of safety. When we launched that in 2012, Brenda was there. Somebody had connected me to her based on her experience. So it just grew from there. My role, function, gift, I'm kind of the great collaborator and connector. We have a lot of talent in the city, a lot of resources in the city, Brenda Wesley being one, Naomi being another, and so many others, Rogers, and drawing that community together so that we could do the work together and amplify the important message of raising awareness and decreasing stigma. And then also doing it at the Communities College, MATC, where we've got 35,000 students, most diverse college in the state. Intersections of all slices of community. So it's a great place to collaborate to provide this message.
You touched upon an important point on how the church sometimes hindered the process of coming out and admitting I have a mental health issue or seeking help. And in addition to outside of church walls, how is the stigma of mental illness perceived in communities of color? And how does this hinder your mission? How are you trying to get your message, you know, not only through this play, but outside of your church walls to people who have this perception?
There was a tragedy some years ago in Milwaukee, maybe 12, 15 years ago. A young boy had autism, and he was at a church, and I presume the church was well-intended. They tried to cast a demon out of him was what they described themselves as doing, so they proceeded to lay over him for hours. It's from an Old Testament narrative, and he ended up suffocating and dying. And I do believe they were probably well-intended, but they were profoundly ill-informed. And so ignorance does a lot of damage. There is a thought that mental illness is a spiritual sickness or possession. And so one of the things I do is I talk about theologically inside the church, the places in the Bible where mental illness is referenced, and there is no connection to spiritual illness. It's an illness just like any other illness. That's the main hurdle, is raising awareness and decreasing the stigma. After that, it's connecting people to the resources. And so as the leader of the faith community, I set the tone by what I talk about and what we preach about across the pulpit. And we've seen over the course of 5 years how it has shaped our community differently. And what that's shown me is that we can shape other communities differently by what we talk about and what we make okay to talk about.
When I started my journey 10, 12 years ago, there was no discussion in the community about mental illness. I knocked on various doors saying that we need to have this discussion about trauma. We need to have this discussion about mental illness. We need to have this discussion about drug addiction. And everyone pretty much turned a blind eye toward until I just kept knocking and knocking and knocking. And now with the miracle and working with Pastor Lanier and how I see other agencies and communities starting to grow and have the conversation, about mental illness and how real it is and that it's a brain disorder, it just kind of encourages my heart, because many times I can tell you I felt like giving up is that who's listening? No one is listening. And we have been doing this production for 7 years. We started in a closet. We started in small venues, had to knock on many doors, and people just pretty much closed the door. But now people are willing to listen to the message of hope. And that's why I call it, it's a message of hope.
And I know with your son, you both have gone through a lot of struggles, particularly with his treatment and how prison hinders that and how treatment, you know, really didn't recognize his mental illness and made the situation even worse.
Yes, indeed. Our prison systems really are becoming our default mental health hospitals, and individuals are being re-traumatized every day. So when I talk about many times, even with the production, just getting kind of tired and knocking on doors because our theme's really changing, I can see change. I can see us going forward a couple of steps, but then I can see us going back 7 steps. Because even now, my son is in Mendota. I myself, being an advocate and being a mom and all the work that I have done, he should not be in Mendota. So when we open the door, which I think is very important with the production and what Pastor Lanier is doing, when we open the door to the community and say these illnesses are real and you need to seek services, but we have to be assured that the door that we send people through understand themselves. And these are the professionals that we hand our loved ones off, because if we don't have a network of a safety network for individuals and we finally convince them to walk through that door, but they're not getting quality services, they're not getting culturally competent services, they're not getting trauma-informed services, they're not getting person-centered services, then what are we doing? Are we going to have another opportunity to get them back through the door once they are traumatized? And that is something that I see that's happening. I can see a shift, but we have to have a sense of urgency, because I say people don't get a chance to come around this life only but one time. And so to tell someone to wait, things will get better. But what about me? What about my son? His life means something. He wasn't just put on this earth just because. So what are we going to do to make sure that we can offer individuals the best quality services around mental illness?
This play takes place on Mental Health Awareness Day, but what do you, both Brenda and Pastor Lanier, want to emphasize with Mental Health Day, and how do we keep that momentum, that sense of urgency, as you alluded to keep that going past this one specific day?
Good question.
We
have to be very intentional about driving the momentum, sustaining the momentum, collaborating and engaging the community with excellence. We're in a city that is rich in resources and talent and assets and opportunities, but we engage in a space of mediocrity because we do not work together well. Part of that is our history, a deeply segregated city across racial lines, also economic lines. That's the bad news. The good news is there's rich opportunity, as reflected even in this day. This is not a day that came together with massive resources, but it came together with passion, intentionality, and a spirit of excellence driven by mission. And it's going to bear fruit. And so we will continue to collaborate and continue to move forward if the partners that we have at the table, which are quite a few, faith-based organizations, NAMI, the Behavioral Health Division, and others, AKAs, let me not forget them. I'll hear about them. A couple of law firms, the Links, the Public Library. And so we'll take charge of continuing this collaboration and this partnership and growing it and moving forward and building it, because mental illness affects, it does not discriminate in any way. resources certainly do, but the illness itself does not in every race, creed, color, gender, sexual orientation, country of origin, economic status has people in their family or them in fact themselves are living with mental illnesses. And we need help, and we need to raise awareness, and we need to be more effective at articulating the resources. And when we do that, we strengthen our community, and we bring a wholeness to the community that's desperately needed.
We have to continue to do that outreach with the service providers. Again, the social workers, the doctors, the case managers, organizations, businesses that are willing to shift their thought process about this illness. And that's even with people that live with drug addiction, is that what does that narrative look like? We use the words like junkies, but are we talking about a disease? So how do we shift people's mindset so they can provide better services around compassion and understanding when we're talking about a biologically based illness?
Pieces in My Own Voice premieres tomorrow at 6:30 at the Milwaukee Area Technical College Cooley Auditorium. It's the culmination of Mental Health Awareness Day, Milwaukee.
Brenda Wesley wrote and directs the play and is also Director of Education and Outreach of the National Alliance of Mental Illness, Greater Milwaukee. Pastor Walter Lanier of the Progressive Baptist Church is the Director of the Men of Color Initiative at MATC. You can find out more at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then revisit an iconic album of the 1990s with the woman who recorded it. A chat with Sean Colvin when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Years ago, those were some of the most familiar musical notes on pop and adult contemporary radio. Before that point, singer-songwriter Sean Colvin had released two albums which had gotten a smattering of commercial attention. But in 1997, her album A Few Small Repairs and the single Sunny Came Home were everywhere.
The song won two Grammys, Song of the Year and Record of the Year, and Colvin went on to record eight more albums, including last year's collaboration with Steve Earle. Tomorrow, Colvin will revisit the entire A Few Small Repairs album in a show at Turner Hall. She joined us ahead of that concert from a hotel room in Colorado. Thanks so much for taking some time to chat.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So I would assume that while you are playing for some people these days who have found you since 1997, there are probably a lot of people in your audiences who have been with you for 20 years or more. And I guess forgive this sort of long and tortured question, but for me, it's hard to listen to an album from 20 years ago without connecting myself to what the music meant to me then and who I was then. As the musician, do you hope for that from your listeners? I mean, do you feel
absolutely.
Like you're playing that?
Yeah, absolutely, because to me, I mean, my own experience with that, with, you know, records that I have owned and loved, and well, that's point. I mean, if you love them, it harkens back. You know, there's nostalgia, and you remember where you were, and you remember what it meant to you, and you remember how you felt, and that, to me, means you love the record.
Did I read this correctly? Is there new album artwork that goes along with the reissue of this album?
No!
No, okay.
No! Exactly the same.
Oh, well, good. Because the thing that one of the things that I remember most strongly about it is these pictures of you in this cornfield.
Yeah, it's still there, kind of a golden-tinged effect. Yeah, still there.
Yeah, you know, and so I lived in Iowa, and I lived in southern Minnesota for a while, and maybe it was seeing those farm pictures, but I always associated the sound of this album with the Midwest. Do you feel like, is it a Midwestern album?
No, but no, I wouldn't call it that. Wichita Skyline was certainly a Midwestern
sure.
song.
Down at the train they go to Independence every day. But anywhere else.
That stands out to me because I specifically was inspired by the plains when I wrote that song.
And by then you had long left the Midwest, right?
Oh yeah, but it stays with you, you know. And that's where I was born, and I was there till I was 12 years old. And at some point, we lived out in the country, and I roamed the prairie a lot, you know, pretending I was a beetle, and I had beetle boots, and I had a faux leather jacket and stovepipe pants, and I would just walk amidst the prairie and amidst the sumac trees and go into fantasies about being a beetle.
You had a very sultry prairie song earlier than that on Fat
exactly.
City.
Yeah.
There have been quite a few interviews with you and articles from the last few months that have pointed out that the album, A Few Small Repairs, was an album that came out in the wake of your divorce. And I don't know that we need to go down that road, but I guess I want to know, how do you view that time in your life 20 years removed from it?
Well, the divorce thing is overdone. I can't remember if that was sort of a record company angle. And certainly Get Out of This House sounds like a very, you know, bitter song about a breakup. It's not at all. It was inspired by buyer's remorse regarding the first house I ever bought. And I was upstairs in this room that I had specifically, you know, designated as my writing room. And it was too much pressure. And I lived across the street from a lake. And I sat up there and got totally stuck because I thought I was supposed to write some great things now that I had this writing room. So it was go jump in the lake, go ride up the hill, get out of this house. And then, you know, because my sort of theory is if you aren't coming up with something that, you know, just out of thin air that you think is great, just start exactly where you are. If it's frustration or feeling loss or lost, or just start where you are. So I literally started where I was, but then I had to fill in the blanks. So Get Out of This House sort of begs an angry tone. And so that wasn't about my ex-husband at all. And where I remember being, I mean, I had some distance from that experience by then. I mean, if anything, you know, it has something to do with that divorce, it's probably If I Were Brave, because we didn't have children, and I have a line in there about, you know, would I be better off had I had one, had a child. And, you know, it just sort of ponders, where do I fit in how relationships work?
But I have this funny ache, and it's burning in my chest, and it spreads just like a fire inside my body. Is it something God left out in my spirit or my flesh? Would I be saved if I were brave and had a baby? It was never clear what would come next, but that's the risk and that's the test.
And then the end was like, well, what I feel like is a person outside of the classic happy marriage or relationship, just entertaining the people that have come to see me that are in happy relationships, which of course is not the case, but that's kind of partly the way I was feeling, like I was the only one.
Well, so, okay, then let me ask you the I guess, more relevant question, and that is, have you made better real estate choices since then?
It was a great house. It was a great real estate choice. It was just, it was a good time in the market. It was across the street from the lake in Austin. It was a divine choice. And I ended up selling it, which I'm, you know, I had buyer's remorse, and now I have seller's regret.
Go jump in the lake, go jump at the door.
So the album art, I'm relieved to hear, has stayed the same. But I gather you and John Leventhal wrote new liner notes for the new version. Is that right?
We did.
So I was reading them, and it was interesting. You know, the thing that jumps out at me from what you write is the point that you recorded the album without any expectations that it would end up on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what those recording sessions were like? Is there a certain, I don't know, lightness that goes with not having heavy expectations?
Absolutely. It was such a gift to have three records under my belt that were not frustrating or you know, fraught in terms of trying to get radio hits. I mean, the record company tried, but I never really expected to be that kind of artist. And it didn't bother me that they didn't really take, you know, in pop radio. And John and I had experience under our belts, and we were more confident, and we kind of made a pact, you know, like, we don't care. We think our songs are radio worthy, but maybe in an alternate universe, you know, and the record company can do what they want. They can pick a single, but we're not going to cut down the time, you know, the number of minutes so that we, you know, we're not going to edit it so we can please radio, and we're not going to change a solo or remix the thing or anything like that. We're just going to hand it in something we love and stand by. And that's the end of it. So we had no pressure or expectations. And it definitely made for a sense of freedom and looseness. And we had fun. And that's not always the case with making a record. And I don't expect it to be. But the making a few smaller pairs was fun.
Well, and so then can I ask you a strange question about Sonny Came Home?
Sure.
I have been listening to this song for, you know, 20 years, and the thing I always notice about that song is the ending, that kind of plaintive riff that also starts the song, and how long the ending goes on. It's like a full 50 seconds.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Sonny came home.
You know, Leventhal is a brilliant songwriter. He wrote the music to that song. I wrote the melody and the lyrics. And he's just a beautiful composer. And the ending of that song is just sort of, it's a coda that repeats the beginning, like you said. And there's just substitute bass notes that start to take it somewhere. That just intend to be evocative and moving and intend to surprise, I think. That was just him being an artist.
Well, and then, you know, I always wonder how many people stick with it long enough to hear the match strike at the very, very, very end.
I don't know. But yeah, we did some fun stuff on that record. We did a match strike. And then at the end of Wichita Skyline, there's a train whistle.
You know, I think I read that this tour is your first extensive full band tour since the first release of A Few Small Repairs. And
not
that you haven't ever played with a full band since then, but is there a certain muscle memory that has to come back to you when you perform with an ensemble versus just, you know, you and a guitar?
That's a good question. And yes, there is, because, you know, my touch is different when it's just me. Also, I can mess with the time. You know, I can be more loose with the cadence of the song and slow it down, you know, not really consciously. I just don't have to be perfectly in tempo with a drummer. And, you know, it's a produced record and there's drums all over it. And that was the thing I was most concerned about, is like, oh, God, I hope I can rally, you know, to being that solid, you know, within the song, and because we're doing the record, you know, from top to bottom. And then there's dynamics that I put in when I'm doing it solo that have nothing to do with the production of the record. You know, they've just developed over time in my solo performances. So given the fact that we're really replicating the record, I had to sort of change some dynamics to fit what we're doing insofar as doing the record. I had to change some dynamics that are you know, not the same as when I play them solo. Playing with a band is its own kind of fun, you know, and it has been a long time. And I'm just, I love being an accompanist. I'm not, you know, I'm just the rhythm guitar player, basically. I've got a backup singer, Larry Campbell's wife, Teresa Williams. They open the show. They're great. And the guys in the band sing. I love harmony singing. It's just so much fun.
Well, Sean Colvin, first of all, thank you so much for your time today. And also thank you for all those evenings on my own in my little apartment in Iowa.
You're welcome. And thank you. And I'm glad it takes you somewhere like that. I think that's one of the most flattering things an artist can hear. So.
Sean Colvin and a full band will play her entire 1997 album, A Few Small Repairs, tomorrow night at Turner Hall Ballroom. She joined us on the line from Boulder, Colorado.
Hold me down to anything, anything that you see. I should walk away.
And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. Stay tuned.
Oh, I love you the most, always giving.